From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. We begin today's program in Myanmar, where the country's ruling party conceded defeat in the general elections. That announcement appears to be the end of more than a quarter of a century of military rule and hand military power to Aung San Suu Kyi's Crisis National League for Democracy. Earlier in the day, the National League for Democracy party spokesman Win Hin Tien said his party was on course to claim more than 70% of the vote. According to the losing military's party acting chairman, the previous government is expected to accept the election results. Liam Cochran, who is the correspondent for ABC News in Myanmar, speaks next to Tim Palmer.
Tim, we're expecting official results probably tomorrow, possibly even Wednesday. So this has come sooner than expected. Reuters news agency is quoting the ruling party leader, Tai Hu, as conceding, saying, "We lost." He's saying that the party has to find out the reasons why they lost, but they do accept the result without any reservations. But this is not an official announcement from the Election Commission, but it is a strong source from the Reuters news agency with this particular claim. And as you said, it does match roughly with comments from the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, that they are polling very, very strongly, 80% in the central regions and around 65% in the states of Mon and Cayenne.
Those figures of 60, 70, 80% of the vote, how does that translate into the parliament, though, given the quota that the military gets?
Well, that's an important point. The military has 25% of seats in the parliament reserved for it. So effectively what that means is the opposition needs to win 67%, two-thirds of the vote, to claim victory outright. And what that means going forward is that they get to choose the president in a further vote in January and form government. So even if they do win, as this announcement appears to suggest, there will be an uneasy period of transfer of power over the next almost 5 months.
Liam, at this stage, has there been any reaction on the streets?
No, this information has literally come in the last few minutes. There's been no reaction to this specific information. However, there was a huge celebration last night in front of the National League for Democracy headquarters. About 10,000 people gathered, singing, cheering. It was very much a victory celebration was the mood there. This is what people expected coming into the vote, that there would be an overwhelming result, a landslide for the NLD. And these recent reports appear unofficially to be confirming that.
Would you expect Aung San Suu Kyi to make any sort of move before the Election Commission does actually confirm the result?
I don't believe so. We saw her appear in an unannounced moment at the party headquarters just a couple of hours ago. She came out, gave a speech from the balcony, and at that point she said it's too early to say whether we have won or not, and urged her supporters to keep calm, wait for the result, be humble if they do win, and urge the losers to respect the outcome. So she seems to be playing it very cautiously and wanting the authorities to take it in announcing this, but it seems the ruling party is all in feeding.
Liam Cochran in Burma speaking to Tim Palmer. Professor Damian Kingsbury is also in the capital following the events as coordinator of the Aaron Election Monitoring Group there. Damian Kingsbury speaks next to Tim Palmer about what he's heard about the concession of military rule.
Well, it's pretty much what you've just reported, that we've had a couple of reports that the ruling USDP has conceded defeat, that they say that they have been beaten and that they accept the result of the ballot, and the NLD has said that they now expect to get 70 or just above 70% of the seats in the parliament, which is just above the requirement, the threshold requirement to form an absolute majority, which will then hand them full power.
Well, can you explain how that works, Professor Kingsbury, that 70% would only translate just into a simple majority?
Yeah, we've just put out a statement earlier today saying that the elections were generally free, but they were structurally unfair. That's because the military still holds 25% of the seats in Parliament. It meant that the ruling USDP and its coalition partners only needed to get 26% of the vote added to the existing military 25% to form an absolute majority, whereas the opposition NLD, the National League for Democracy of Aung San Suu Kyi, would require 67% of the seats in Parliament in order to counter that 25% that the military already holds. So it's a very high threshold. It showed that the process was constitutionally unfair, but it does now look like that the NLD has passed that threshold and will be able to form an absolute majority government.
Does the fact that the outgoing, it seems, military party, that it's conceded so early, does that relax any concerns you might have had about the potential for vote tampering?
Oh, look, it's certainly been a big concern that many people have had. Having said that, the vote counting process was very open and transparent, and there were certainly party officials as well as observers at all of the polling stations around the country. And we watched the count last night go through, and we saw every single ballot paper being counted. So we knew quite clearly what the result was in every polling station. The question was really going to be about the cumulative count. It still has to go through a number of steps before a final formal announcement is going to be made, and that still might take a couple of days. It's convoluted, unnecessarily convoluted process. But I think what the USDP is recognising is that there were so many people there watching that it is so transparent that it would be impossible now for anybody to try to steal the election away. It would throw the country into absolute chaos. So I think they did say that they would respect the result on Thursday. President Thein Sein said he would respect the result and the military would respect the result. And it now appears that's what they're doing.
So given that conjunction of events right now, would you allow yourself to feel that this is something of a moment in history, ending more than a quarter of a century of the military junta's control over Burma? Are you allowing yourself to celebrate that now, or are you going to wait until Aung San Suu Kyi officially accepts that she has won?
Yeah, okay. It's a good question. Just for historical accuracy, the military has been in power in one form or another since 1962. So it's been 25 years since there was an election, but that election result was never regarded as acceptable to the military, and the military just continued the rule that it has had prior to the election process. So it's been over a half a century of military rule in this country, and it's very difficult to be here now and not feel some sense of elation. It's an extraordinary event. It's certainly of historic proportions. And when we were leaving the polling stations last night after the count had finished, the ordinary local people were out in the streets and they were all smiling and waving and saying thank you, I guess, just for being there and sharing the occasion with them. We're having a meeting, a dinner of our observer team tonight, and I think it's going to be a celebratory dinner. Not because necessarily we were biased in favour of one party or another, but because the result has reflected the will of the people.
Burma's democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi said her party won well above the threshold needed to govern in its own right. But she expressed concern that the country's military generals may not keep their pledge to respect the election result. This has stopped her through from boldly restating her intention to be president in everything but name, as Ann Baker reports.
It's an historic moment. Myanmar's Election Commission Chairman Tin Ai announces the first winners from Sunday's election. 29 of the 33 candidates confirmed in the upper house are from Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, which claims to have won 81% of the popular vote, although the party's leader isn't celebrating yet.
This is just the beginning of the road. We're just at the gate, as it were, and there's a lot more to be done before I think our people will feel secure enough to celebrate.
Secure or not, the democracy leader has told the BBC she expects to be Myanmar's president in everything but name.
It's a name only. a rose by any other name.
Myanmar's constitution bars Aung San Suu Kyi from being president because her two sons are foreign citizens, but she's reiterated her intention to be above the president.
Well, I'll make all the decisions. It's as simple as all that. If I'm required to field a president who meets the requirements of Section 59F of the constitution, all right, we'll find one. But that won't stop me from making all the decisions as the leader of the winning party.
The statement puts Aung San Suu Kyi on a potential collision course with Myanmar's military leaders, who are guaranteed 25% of all seats in the new parliament and therefore an effective veto over any attempt to change the constitution. But the NLD leader says any attempt to sabotage her government will also sabotage the will of the people.
Well, they've been saying repeatedly that they'll respect the will of the people and that they will implement the results of the election.
It's a vast change from 25 years ago when the same opposition leader and the same party won elections in 1990 and military leaders responded by putting her under house arrest. Some fear that her bold claims to the presidency, with or without the title, will again force the military to intervene. Despite the flaws in the electoral process, election observers say they're optimistic about Myanmar's transition to democracy. Mary Robinson heads the Carter Centre, a human rights NGO.
Myanmar is definitely on a positive trajectory towards a peaceful, democratic transition. That's what People Power did on the 8th of November. The people of Myanmar have been empowered.
Professor Monique Skidmore is Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Queensland and a Myanmar specialist who lived and worked in the country for years. She says Aung San Suu Kyi might well become effective president, but only if the presidential nominee agrees to become a puppet leader.
I think that if they can get the numbers to ensure that the NLD, the National League for Democracy, is able to field the presidential candidate, and assuming that that person is willing to bow to all of the policy decisions made by the National League for Democracy, then yes, she will effectively rule as president.
But it will depend very much then on who that person is.
Absolutely. And it will depend upon, over time, individual elected members as well having a say in parliament and whether or not they will always fall in line behind Aung San Suu Kyi's views.
Are you confident that the military will keep its promise to respect the election results and not intervene?
I think I've been working in Burma for just too long to really assume that the military will completely withdraw. A coup could occur at any time. And it is also the case that the military regime will not go down quietly if she does seek to dismantle the economic oligopolies. So the military essentially carved the country up before it ceded power and owns most of the large industries in the country. And that's their power base. And it will be interesting to see what happens if Aung San Suu Kyi seeks over time to dismantle that.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Exploration of Papua New Guinea's vast rainforest has seen the country become the largest exporter of logs in the world. The large-scale logging has intensified environmental concerns, and the PNG government has just promised to stop the export of unlimited rainforest logs to improve forest sustainability. As we hear from PNG correspondent Eric Tolzik.
The northern part of the border between Papua New Guinea and Indonesia is dominated by towering rainforests and the Asian logging companies who are clearing it. They're using the pretext of agricultural development to gain access. Eddie Tanago is a social justice activist for the charity Act Now PNG. He's been representing landholders from isolated villages across Papua New Guinea who have lost their land to companies on 99-year special agricultural business leases, or SABLs.
The loggers, in the guise of saying that, you know, they're general agricultural companies, they come in the excuse of doing agriculture, they come in to do logging. So we see that SABLs has been abused in that process.
Peter Wooney is a landholder from Bawani, home to PNG's largest SABL. He says he's been threatened after he spoke out against the lease.
We want development, but the development is not being fully delivered to the people.
Like many landholders, Peter Wooney is worried about the large-scale loss of the rainforest. Joel Essay is another landholder who says the logging is affecting the many small communities who rely on the rivers and the forest for food and water.
We have no way to go and hunt fish and collect all our needs and wants in the forest like in the past our ancestors and our parents normally do.
The operators of the Bawani project didn't want to speak to the ABC. But unlike many other operators on SABLs, they are actually planting oil palm and appear to be developing an agricultural business. A government inquiry and investigations by international monitoring organisations have found many of the other operators are simply logging or making token efforts at agricultural development. Rick Jacobson is from environmental transparency organisation Global Witness.
There's little or no agricultural development, but a lot of logging. In those cases, we suspect that these agricultural leases are actually just being used as a front.
Papua New Guinea's Forestry Minister, Douglas Tomuriesa, says the government doesn't wish to penalise those operators who have invested heavily in SABLs. Mr Tomuriesa says the government is waiting on a final report from a special task force investigating the leases. He says it will then work with the companies to ensure they're operating legally and with the consent of landowners.
You have to deal each one of them based on their status. And when I say status, you're talking about how much development has been done down there, and if it's illegal, it can be cancelled.
But Rick Jacobson from Global Witness says logging operations have been ramping up while the government holds various inquiries.
We found that this about 40% of PNG's timber exports are coming out of those types of leases. So now we're in late 2015, and yet not a single one of those logging operations has stopped. So we're talking 2.5 years later, and the government hasn't done anything, as far as we can tell, to stop what's happening on the ground, which is really resulting in irreversible harm to PNG's landowners and their forests.
The PNG government says it will release the findings of its task force and start working with the operators of the leases in the near future.
The riot that took place at the Christmas Island Detention Centre is over, but it took tear gas and some force to bring it to an end. Australia's Immigration Minister Peter Dutton says authorities have regained control, but there has been over $1 million in damage. The Immigration Department says the core group of detainees had made improvised weapons and built barricades to resist authorities attempting to wreak back control of the compound. Louise Yaxley has the story.
The riot broke out after the death of Iranian Kurdish refugee Faisal Chagani, but the detention centre is now home not just to asylum seekers, but also to people being deported after they've spent time in jail and are having their visas cancelled on character grounds. Peter Dutton says there were convicted criminals involved.
We have 11 people who have been convicted of armed robbery. There are 27 people who have been convicted of assault, 5 people who have been convicted of child sex offences. There are 4 there for drug offences, 9 for grievous bodily harm, 2 for manslaughter. The list goes on and on, including 4 people who have been convicted of rape or sexual assault, 9 people of theft, robbery, break and enter.
Mr Dutton says some detainees agreed to come out peacefully, but force was used on those who refused to comply.
Police on entry into the centre will use reasonable force, and it will depend on the force used against them by the detainees, bearing in mind that we've got members of outlaw motorcycle gangs, people who are rated as extreme risk within that population. They are the people that make up the population within the Christmas Island Immigration Detention Centre, and the federal police will use necessary force to make sure that they counter the risk posed to them.
The minister only gave limited information when pressed about what he meant by reasonable force.
So will you say definitively whether tear gas or rubber bullets were used and were part of the use of force?
I understand that there was some use of tear gas. I have no advice in relation to rubber bullets.
Mr Dutton calls it a melee and makes the point that there was no breach of the perimeter fence.
So at no stage was there any threat to people within the Christmas Island community.
But he says there's some severe damage at the centre.
I think there's well over $1 million worth of damage, and I think people who have caused that damage, who have put taxpayers to the great expense of fixing that damage, will face the full force of the law. And if people think they can intimidate the government by this sort of thuggish and illegal behaviour, They've got another thing coming.
Labor's Richard Marles has questions about the appropriateness of the mix between asylum seekers and hardened criminals in the centre.
I think that's a very good question. And, I mean, obviously this is a large facility and there'll be different areas within the facility, but I think the Australian people do need to have a sense of confidence about that very legitimate question. Are those people in the same areas? Is there are people being mixed, as that report just indicated, and it's very obvious we're talking about different clientele, and they need to be managed in different ways. And the answer to that question very much goes to the safety of everyone concerned, which is why I think it's important that we actually hear from the Minister about what's going on here, that we have some transparency in relation to this.
But in New Zealand, there are even more questions about what's happening to their citizens who've spent time in jail in Australia. The Prime Minister, John Key, hit back at New Zealand Labor critics of his handling of the situation.
Because these people, some of them are rapists, some of them are child molesters, and some of them are murderers. And these are the people that the Labor Party is saying are more important to support than New Zealanders who deserve protecting when they come back here. Mr. Davis, if you want to put yourself on the side of sex offenders, go ahead, my son, but we'll defend New Zealanders.
Irate Australian parents are flooding social media with their concerns about being unable to feed their babies because of a shortage of formula suppliers. The rush on baby formula from Asian countries like China has stripped local supermarkets and pharmacy shelves. But one group of Australian dairy farmers is looking at the upside of this unprecedented foreign demand. Rachel Brown reports.
Sudhashima Varadarajan is one of countless Australian parents struggling to feed their children because of a shortage of local infant formula.
I started with Bellamy's formula about 4 months back, and since 2 months it's been so bad that I cannot secure one or two tins of the product in one go ever.
Ms. Varadarajan was having to drive a tired route between all the supermarkets in a 20-kilometre radius of her home on Sydney's northern beaches for her 16-month-old daughter, Ariana.
So I'm trying to order it online. I'm trying to get in touch with people from Bellamy's and they tell me when things are going to go stock online. And I'm trying to be online pretty much 5 or 6 times a day to try and check if I can order tins.
The demand for Australia's clean and green milk products largely stems from the 2008 Chinese milk scandal, in which 6 babies died and thousands more became ill after drinking milk tainted with the toxic chemical melamine. The consumer advocacy group Choice says foreign students, Chinese nationals and buying agents are buying in bulk to send the formula home. It's also created a market for profiteers on sites like China's eBay equivalent, where a $20 tin can sell for up to $100. Choice's Kate Brown.
We've seen examples of Australian brand formula on sale on Chinese websites for up to 4 times the price it retails here. So certainly, you know, there is the opportunity to make quite a nice income from doing that, or even just if you're happening to visit here and you're on your way home, you could pretty much pay off probably the cost of your trip.
Kate Brown adds there's probably also an element of panic buying by Australian parents.
We're seeing entire shelves being cleared of product and parents saying that they're visiting up to 20 or 30 stores to try and find the formula that they need for their baby.
The major retailers Woolworths and Coles have set limits per customer of 4 and 8 tins. One of the major infant formula companies, Bellamy's Organic, says it's working to ensure its supplier and manufacturing schedules are prepared for future surges in demand. It's also set up an online store in China and an office in Shanghai. Kate Brown says that's the company's prerogative. But she suggests because of the important nature of the product, milk powder manufacturers should guarantee local supply first.
We're looking at babies that are under 12 months old, particularly babies that are exclusively formula fed. I do think there is, you know, a duty of care by retailers to make that available to Australian parents who up until recently have been able to go to the shops and purchase that product.
A rush on milk powder looks like creating a bigger market for Australian dairy farmers. Peter Nathan, CEO of the trans-Tasman company A2 Milk, says demand has accelerated so dramatically, his company will have to build special herds to meet it. But that will take time.
What we have to do is to build additional herds because we are the only brand that has a product which contains milk powder, which contains only the A2 type of protein and not A1. So what that means is we have to breed cows that naturally produce the A2 protein, and that takes a little bit of time to select exploit those cows which naturally produce the proteins.
Mr Nathan says A2 Milk is considering building an extra processing plant.
Any sort of building a plant in conjunction with other parties is a longer lead time, and we'll be not making the short term. In the immediate term, the focus for us is to build supply and capacity with our existing supply.
And finally on the program, the Chinese economy may be slowing down, but that hasn't dampened enthusiasm for the annual online sales frenzy known as Singles Day. It began as an unofficial celebration of bachelor life that was started by a lonely university student, or students rather. But in recent years, the day has become ruthlessly exploited by the online sales giant Alibaba and its rivals. Bill Bertels reports from China.
At one of Beijing's most popular shopping spots in Sanlitun District, customers are few and far between. One day before the online frenzy, most people the world today spoke to were holding off and waiting for the discounts.
I want to buy stuff because all the websites are really fighting with each other for customers. I don't know how much I will spend, maybe up to $250.
I'll have a look. If I see clothes or things I want, I'll buy. If not, I won't. I would probably spend up to $700.
Singles Day could perhaps be compared to the Boxing Day sales, just on a much, much bigger scale. Last year, in 24 hours, Chinese consumers bought more than $12 billion worth of goods, ranging from electronics to cut-price airline tickets. The head of the China e-business research center in the city of Hangzhou, Cao Lei, says all signs point to even higher sales this year.
This year, the sales may come close to $18 billion. On that one day alone, in a few years' time, we might even see more than $20 billion worth of sales.
The mass consumption is a long way from the ruling Communist Party's original ideals. But Sean Ryan, a Shanghai-based market research analyst, says these days it's exactly what the leaders want to help the slowing economy.
E-commerce sales in the United States only accounts for about 15% of retail sales. In China, it's about 25%, and we expect it to hit 50% within the next 5 years, as e-commerce plays a much bigger role.
China's biggest e-commerce company, Alibaba, expects to ship 20 million parcels for Singles Day this year. At the front line of this logistical challenge are the delivery men who whiz around major cities on motorized tricycles, going up and down lifts all day delivering parcels. Cao Lei says after today, they'll be stretched to the limit.
It's like an explosion. In one day, they get as many orders as they normally would in 1 month. The delivery companies need to work overtime to send all this.
But not everyone's getting caught up in the frenzy. Back at the Sanlitun shops, this woman says there's still far too many fake knockoffs for sale online. It's a complaint heard far too often here.
And with that report from Bill Bertels in Beijing, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can also send them along. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Until next time, so long, and take care.